From Public Radio International, this is The World. A co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. It's Tuesday, December 1st. I'm Marco Werman. Barack Obama is about to announce that he'll send more troops to Afghanistan. The troops already there will be listening. Specialist Kyle Mitchell wants lots of reinforcements.
It's way, way, way undermanned here. I tell my family all the time, like, no, there's not close to enough troops here.
But this sergeant says it makes no difference what the president does.
I think it's a lost cause. It's a lose-lose situation. No matter what we do, I don't think it's going to change much.
Ahead, the president speaks on Afghanistan. Barack Obama has been thinking about this for 3 months. In a moment, he will announce his strategy for prosecuting the war in Afghanistan. The president is about to speak to the nation from the U.S. Military Academy in West Point, New York. He's decided to send another 30,000 U.S. troops to join the fight. That would take the U.S. force in Afghanistan to more than 100,000. Mr. Obama will also say that troops will start leaving Afghanistan in July 2011. Charlie Sennett is editor of the online globalpost.com. He was in Afghanistan earlier this year. Charlie, I don't know how much time we have before President Obama actually makes this address, but tell us, first of all, who's he addressing tonight? Who is his speech intended for?
Well, I think that's really intended for a nation that's quite skeptical, and I think that though he's at West Point addressing the cadets, they are part of the cast for a stage. He's really speaking to the nation.
And here is President Barack Obama.
Thank you. Thank you. Please be seated. Good evening. To the United States Corps of Cadets, to the men and women of our armed services, and to my fellow Americans. I want to speak to you tonight about our effort in Afghanistan, the nature of our commitment there, the scope of our interests, and the strategy that my administration will pursue to bring this war to a successful conclusion. It's an extraordinary honor for me to do so here at West Point, where so many men and women have prepared to stand up for our security and to represent what is finest about our country. To address these important issues, it's important to recall why America and our allies were compelled to fight a war in Afghanistan in the first place. We did not ask for this fight. On September 11, 2001, 19 men hijacked four airplanes and used them to murder nearly 3,000 people. They struck at our military and economic nerve centers. They took the lives of innocent men, women, and children, without regard to their faith or race or station. Were it not for the heroic actions of passengers on board one of these flights, they could have also struck at one of the great symbols of our democracy in Washington and killed many more. As we know, these men belonged to al-Qaeda, a group of extremists who have distorted and defiled Islam, one of the world's great religions, to justify the slaughter of innocents. Al-Qaeda's base of operations was in Afghanistan, where they were harbored by the Taliban, a ruthless, repressive, and radical movement that seized control of that country after it was ravaged by years of Soviet occupation and civil war, and after the attention of America and our friends had turned elsewhere. Just days after 9/11, Congress authorized the use of force against al-Qaeda and those who harbored them, an authorization that continues to this day. The vote in the Senate was 98 to nothing. The vote in the House was 420 to 1. For the first time in its history, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization invoked Article 5, the commitment that says an attack on one member nation is an attack on all. And the United Nations Security Council endorsed the use of all necessary steps to respond to the 9/11 attacks, America, our allies, and the world were acting as one to destroy al-Qaeda's terrorist network and to protect our common security. Under the banner of this domestic unity and international legitimacy, and only after the Taliban refused to turn over Osama bin Laden, we sent our troops into Afghanistan. Within a matter of months, al-Qaeda was scattered and many of its operatives were killed. The Taliban was driven from power and pushed back on its heels. A place that had known decades of fear now had reason to hope. At a conference convened by the UN, a provisional government was established under President Hamid Karzai, and an international security assistance force was established to help bring a lasting peace to a war-torn country. Then, in early 2003, the decision was made to wage a second war in Iraq. The wrenching debate over the Iraq War is well known and need not be repeated here. It's enough to say that for the next 6 years, the Iraq War drew the dominant share of our troops, our resources, our diplomacy, and our national attention, and that the decision to go into Iraq caused substantial rifts between America and much of the world. Today, after extraordinary costs, we are bringing the Iraq War to a responsible end. We will remove our combat brigades from Iraq by the end of next summer, and all of our troops by the end of 2011. That we are doing so is a testament to the character of the men and women in uniform. Thanks to their courage, grit, and perseverance, we have given Iraqis a chance to shape their future, and we are successfully leaving Iraq to its people. But while we've achieved hard-earned milestones in Iraq, the situation in Afghanistan has deteriorated. After escaping across the border into Pakistan in 2001 and 2002, al-Qaeda's leadership established a safe haven there. Although a legitimate government was elected by the Afghan people, it's been hampered by corruption, the drug trade, an underdeveloped economy, and insufficient security forces. Over the last several years, the Taliban has maintained common cause with al-Qaeda as they both seek an overthrow of the Afghan government. Gradually, the Taliban has begun to control additional swaths of territory in Afghanistan while engaging in increasingly brazen and devastating attacks of terrorism against the Pakistani people. Now, throughout this period, our troop levels in Afghanistan remained a fraction of what they were in Iraq. When I took office, we had just over 32,000 Americans serving in Afghanistan, compared to 160,000 in Iraq at the peak of the war. Commanders in Afghanistan repeatedly asked for support to deal with the reemergence of the Taliban, but these reinforcements did not arrive. And that's why, shortly after taking office, I approved a long-standing request for more troops. After consultations with our allies, I then announced a strategy recognizing the fundamental connection between our war effort in Afghanistan and the extremist safe havens in Pakistan. I set a goal that was narrowly defined as disrupting, dismantling, and defeating al-Qaeda and its extremist allies, and pledged to better coordinate our military and civilian efforts. Since then, we've made progress on some important objectives. High-ranking al-Qaeda and Taliban leaders have been killed, and we've stepped up the pressure on al-Qaeda worldwide. In Pakistan, that nation's army has gone on its largest offensive in years. In Afghanistan, we and our allies prevented the Taliban from stopping a presidential election. And although it was marred by fraud, that election produced a government that is consistent with Afghanistan's laws and constitution. Yet huge challenges remain. Afghanistan is not lost, but for several years it has moved backwards. There's no imminent threat of the government being overthrown, but the Taliban has gained momentum. Al-Qaeda has not reemerged in Afghanistan in the same numbers as before 9/11, but they retain their safe havens along the border. and our forces lack the full support they need to effectively train and partner with Afghan security forces and better secure the population. Our new commander in Afghanistan, General McChrystal, has reported that the security situation is more serious than he anticipated. In short, the status quo is not sustainable. As cadets, you volunteered for service during this time of danger. Some of you fought in Afghanistan. Some of you will deploy there. As your commander-in-chief, I owe you a mission that is clearly defined and worthy of your service. And that's why, after the Afghan voting was completed, I insisted on a thorough review of our strategy. Now, let me be clear. There has never been an option before me that called for troop deployments before 2010. So there has been no delay or denial of resources necessary for the conduct of the war during this review period. Instead, the review has allowed me to ask the hard questions and to explore all the different options, along with my national security team, our military and civilian leadership in Afghanistan, and our key partners. And given the stakes involved, I owed the American people and our troops no less. This review is now complete. And as Commander-in-Chief, I have determined that it is in our vital national interest to send an additional 30,000 U.S. troops to Afghanistan. After 18 months, our troops will begin to come home. These are the resources that we need to seize the initiative while building the Afghan capacity that can allow for a responsible transition of our forces out of Afghanistan. I do not make this decision lightly. I opposed the war in Iraq precisely because I believe that we must exercise restraint in the use of military force and always consider the long-term consequences of our actions. We have been at war now for 8 years, at enormous cost in lives and resources. Years of debate over Iraq and terrorism have left our unity on national security issues in tatters and created a highly polarized and partisan backdrop for this effort. And having just experienced the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression, the American people are understandably focused on rebuilding our economy and putting people to work here at home. Most of all, I know that this decision asks even more of you, a military that, along with your families, has already borne the heaviest of all burdens. As President, I have signed a letter of condolence to the family of each American who gives their life in these wars. I have read the letters from the parents and spouses of those who deployed. I visited our courageous wounded warriors at Walter Reed. I've traveled to Dover to meet the flag-draped caskets of 18 Americans returning home to their final resting place. I see firsthand the terrible wages of war. If I did not think that the security of the United States and the safety of the American people were at stake in Afghanistan, I would gladly order every single one of our troops home tomorrow. So no, I do not make this decision lightly. I make this decision because I am convinced that our security is at stake in Afghanistan and Pakistan. This is the epicenter of violent extremism practiced by al-Qaeda. It is from here that we were attacked on 9/11, and it is from here that new attacks are being plotted as I speak. This is no idle danger, no hypothetical threat. In the last few months alone, we have apprehended extremists within our borders who were sent here from the border region of Afghanistan and Pakistan to commit new acts of terror. And this danger will only grow if the region slides backwards and al-Qaeda can operate with impunity. We must keep the pressure on al-Qaeda, and to do that, we must increase the stability and capacity of our partners in the region. Of course, this burden is not ours alone to bear. This is not just America's war. Since 9/11, al-Qaeda's safe havens have been the source of attacks against London and Amman and Bali. The people and governments of both Afghanistan and Pakistan are in danger.
And the stakes are even higher within a nuclear-armed Pakistan because we know that al-Qaeda and other extremists seek nuclear weapons, and we have every reason to believe that they would use them. These facts compel us to act along with our friends and allies. Our overarching goal remains the same: to disrupt, dismantle, and defeat al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and to prevent its capacity to threaten America and our allies in the future. To meet that goal, we will pursue the following objectives within Afghanistan. We must deny al-Qaeda a safe haven. We must reverse the Taliban's momentum and deny it the ability to overthrow the government. And we must strengthen the capacity of Afghanistan's security forces and government so that they can take lead responsibility for Afghanistan's future. We will meet these objectives in three ways. First, we will pursue a military strategy that will break the Taliban's momentum and increase Afghanistan's capacity over the next 18 months. The 30,000 additional troops that I'm announcing tonight will deploy in the first part of 2010, the fastest possible pace, so that they can target the insurgency and secure key population centers. They'll increase our ability to train competent Afghan security forces and to partner with them so that more Afghans can get into the fight. And they will help create the conditions for the United States to transfer responsibility to the Afghans. Because this is an international effort, I've asked that our commitment be joined by contributions from our allies. Some have already provided additional troops, and we're confident that there will be further contributions in the days and weeks ahead. Our friends have fought and bled and died alongside us in Afghanistan. And now we must come together to end this war successfully. For what's at stake is not simply a test of NATO's credibility. What's at stake is the security of our allies and the common security of the world. Now, taken together, these additional American and international troops will allow us to accelerate handing over responsibility to Afghan forces and allow us to begin the transfer of our forces out of Afghanistan in July of 2011. Just as we have done in Iraq, we will execute this transition responsibly, taking into account conditions on the ground. We'll continue to advise and assist Afghanistan's security forces to ensure that they can succeed over the long haul. But it will be clear to the Afghan government, and more importantly to the Afghan people, that they will ultimately be responsible for their own country. Second, we will work with our partners, the United Nations, and the Afghan people to pursue a more effective civilian strategy so that the government can take advantage of improved security. This effort must be based on performance. The days of providing a blank check are over. President Karzai's inauguration speech sent the right message about moving in a new direction. And going forward, we will be clear about what we expect from those who receive our assistance. We'll support Afghan ministries, governors, and local leaders that combat corruption and deliver for the people. We expect those who are ineffective or corrupt to be held accountable. And we will also focus our assistance in areas such as agriculture that can make an immediate impact in the lives of the Afghan people. Now, the people of Afghanistan have endured violence for decades. They've been confronted with occupation by the Soviet Union and then by foreign al-Qaeda fighters who used Afghan land for their own purposes. So tonight, I want the Afghan people to understand. America seeks an end to this era of war and suffering. We have no interest in occupying your country. We will support efforts by the Afghan government to open the door to those Taliban who abandon violence and respect the human rights of their fellow citizens. And we will seek a partnership with Afghanistan grounded in mutual respect, to isolate those who destroy, to strengthen those who build, to hasten the day when our troops will leave, and to forge a lasting friendship in which America is your partner and never your patron. Third, we will act with the full recognition that our success in Afghanistan is inextricably linked to our partnership with Pakistan.
We're in Afghanistan to prevent a cancer from once again spreading through that country. But this same cancer has also taken root in the border region of Pakistan. And that's why we need a strategy that works on both sides of the border. In the past, there have been those in Pakistan who have argued that the struggle against extremism is not their fight, and that Pakistan is better off doing little or seeking accommodation with those who use violence. But in recent years, as innocents have been killed from Karachi to Islamabad, it has become clear that it is the Pakistani people who are the most endangered by extremism. Public opinion has turned. The Pakistani army has waged an offensive in Swat and South Waziristan. And there is no doubt that the United States and Pakistan share a common enemy. In the past, we too often defined our relationship with Pakistan narrowly. And those days are over. Moving forward, we are committed to a partnership with Pakistan that is built on a foundation of mutual interest, mutual respect, and mutual trust. We will strengthen Pakistan's capacity to target those groups that threaten our countries and have made it clear that we cannot tolerate a safe haven for terrorists whose location is known and whose intentions are clear. America is also providing substantial resources to support Pakistan's democracy and development. We are the largest international supporter for those Pakistanis displaced by the fighting. And going forward, the Pakistan people must know America will remain a strong supporter of Pakistan's security and prosperity long after the guns have fallen silent, so that the great potential of its people can be unleashed. These are the three core elements of our strategy: a military effort to create the conditions for a transition, a civilian surge that reinforces positive action, and an effective partnership with Pakistan. Now, I recognize there are a range of concerns about our approach. So let me briefly address a few of the more prominent arguments that I've heard, and which I take very seriously. First, there are those who suggest that Afghanistan is another Vietnam. They argue that it cannot be stabilized, and we're better off cutting our losses and rapidly withdrawn. I believe this argument depends on a false reading of history. Unlike Vietnam, we are joined by a broad coalition of 43 nations that recognizes the legitimacy of our action. Unlike Vietnam, we are not facing a broad-based popular insurgency. And most importantly, unlike Vietnam, the American people were viciously attacked from Afghanistan and remain a target for those same extremists who are plotting along its border. To abandon this area now and to rely only on efforts against al-Qaeda from a distance would significantly hamper our ability to keep the pressure on al-Qaeda and create an unacceptable risk of additional attacks on our homeland and our allies. Second, there are those who acknowledge that we can't leave Afghanistan in its current state, but suggest that we go forward with the troops that we already have. But this would simply maintain a status quo in which we muddle through and permit a slow deterioration of conditions there. It would ultimately prove more costly and prolong our stay in Afghanistan because we would never be able to generate the conditions needed to train Afghan security forces and give them the space to take over. Finally, there are those who oppose identifying a time frame for our transition to Afghan responsibility. Indeed, some call for a more dramatic and open-ended escalation of our war effort, one that would commit us to a nation-building project of up to a decade. I reject this course because it sets goals that are beyond what can be achieved at a reasonable cost and what we need to achieve to secure our interests. Furthermore, the absence of a time frame for transition would deny us any sense of urgency in working with the Afghan government. It must be clear that Afghans will have to take responsibility for their security, and that America has no interest in fighting an endless war in Afghanistan. As president, I refuse to set goals that go beyond our responsibility our means, or our interests. And I must weigh all of the challenges that our nation faces. I don't have the luxury of committing to just one. Indeed, I'm mindful of the words of President Eisenhower, who, in discussing our national security, said, "Each proposal must be weighed in the light of a broader consideration, the need to maintain balance in and among national programs." Over the past several years, we have lost that balance. We failed to appreciate the connection between our national security and our economy. In the wake of an economic crisis, too many of our neighbors and friends are out of work and struggle to pay the bills. Too many Americans are worried about the future facing our children. Meanwhile, competition within the global economy has grown more fierce, so we can't simply afford to ignore the price of these wars. All told, by the time I took office, the cost of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan approached $1 trillion. Going forward, I am committed to addressing these costs openly and honestly. Our new approach in Afghanistan is likely to cost us roughly $30 billion for the military this year. And I'll work closely with Congress to address these costs as we work to bring down our deficit. But as we end the war in Iraq and transition to Afghan responsibility, we must rebuild our strength here at home. Our prosperity provides a foundation for our power. It pays for our military, it underwrites our diplomacy, it taps the potential of our people and allows investment in new industry, and it will allow us to compete in this century as successfully as we did in the last. That's why our troop commitment in Afghanistan cannot be open-ended, because the nation that I'm most interested in building is our own. Now, let me be clear. None of this will be easy. The struggle against violent extremism will not be finished quickly, and it extends well beyond Afghanistan and Pakistan. It will be an enduring test of our free society and our leadership in the world. And unlike the great power conflicts and clear lines of division that defined the 20th century, our effort will involve disorderly regions, failed states, diffuse enemies. So as a result, America will have to show our strength in the way that we end wars and prevent conflict, not just how we wage wars. We'll have to be nimble and precise in our use of military power. Where Al-Qaeda and its allies attempt to establish a foothold, whether in Somalia or Yemen or elsewhere, they must be confronted by growing pressure and strong partnerships. And we can't count on military might alone. We have to invest in our homeland security because we can't capture or kill every violent extremist abroad. We have to improve and better coordinate our intelligence so that we stay one step ahead of shadowy networks. We will have to take away the tools of mass destruction. And that's why I've made it a central pillar of my foreign policy to secure loose nuclear materials from terrorists, to stop the spread of nuclear weapons, and to pursue the goal of a world without them. Because every nation must understand that true security will never come from an endless race for ever more destructive weapons. True security will come for those who reject them. We'll have to use diplomacy, because no one nation can meet the challenges of an interconnected world acting alone. I've spent this year renewing our alliances and forging new partnerships. And we have forged a new beginning between America and the Muslim world, one that recognizes our mutual interest in breaking a cycle of conflict and that promises a future in which those who kill innocents are isolated by those who stand up for peace and prosperity and human dignity. And finally, we must draw on the strength of our values. For the challenges that we face may have changed, but the things that we believe in must not. And that's why we must promote our values by living them at home, which is why I have prohibited torture and will close the prison at Guantanamo Bay. And we must make it clear to every man, woman, and child around the world who lives under the dark cloud of tyranny that America will speak out on behalf of their human rights and tend to the light of freedom and justice and opportunity and respect for the dignity of all peoples. That is who we are. That is the source, the moral source of America's authority. Since the days of Franklin Roosevelt and the service and sacrifice of our grandparents and great-grandparents, our country has borne a special burden in global affairs. We have spilled American blood in many countries on multiple continents. We have spent our revenue to help others rebuild from rubble and develop their own economies. We have joined with others to develop an architecture of institutions from the United Nations to NATO to the World Bank that provide for the common security and prosperity of human beings. We have not always been thanked for these efforts, and we have at times made mistakes. But more than any other nation, the United States of America has underwritten global security for over six decades, a time that, for all its problems, has seen walls come down and markets open and billions lifted from poverty, unparalleled scientific progress and advancing frontiers of human liberty. For unlike the great powers of old, we have not sought world domination. Our union was founded in resistance to oppression. We do not seek to occupy other nations. We will not claim another nation's resources or target other peoples because their faith or ethnicity is different from ours. What we have fought for, what we continue to fight for, is a better future for our children and grandchildren, and we believe that their lives will be better if other people's children and grandchildren can live in freedom and access opportunity. As a country, we're not as young and perhaps not as innocent as we were when Roosevelt was president. Yet we are still heirs to a noble struggle for freedom. And now we must summon all of our might and moral suasion to meet the challenges of a new age. In the end, our security and leadership does not come solely from the strength of our arms. It derives from our people, from the workers and businesses who will rebuild our economy, from the entrepreneurs and researchers who will pioneer new industries, from the teachers that will educate our children, and the service of those who work in our communities at home, from the diplomats and Peace Corps volunteers who spread hope abroad, and from the men and women in uniform who are part of an unbroken line of sacrifice that has made government of the people, by the people, and for the people a reality on this earth. This vast and diverse citizenry will not always agree on every issue, nor should we. But I also know that we as a country cannot sustain our leadership nor navigate the momentous challenges of our time if we allow ourselves to be split asunder by the same rancor and cynicism and partisanship that has in recent times poisoned our national discourse. It's easy to forget that when this war began, we were united, bound together by the fresh memory of a horrific attack and by the determination to defend our homeland and the values we hold dear. I refuse to accept the notion that we cannot summon that unity again. I believe with every fiber of my being that we, as Americans, can still come together behind a common purpose. For our values are not simply words written into parchment. They are a creed that calls us together and that has carried us through the darkest of storms as one nation, as one people. America, we are passing through a time of great trial. And the message that we send in the midst of these storms must be clear, that our cause is just, our resolve unwavering. We will go forward with the confidence that right makes might, and with the commitment to forge an America that is safer, a world that is more secure, and a future that represents not the deepest of fears, but the highest of hopes. Thank you. God bless you, and God bless the United States of America. Thank you very much.
That was President Barack Obama speaking at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point in New York. Mr. Obama declared that America's security is at stake in Afghanistan, and he announced that he has ordered an additional 30,000 U.S. troops into the war there. The president said the first of those forces will arrive by Christmas, but Mr. Obama also said that the U.S. commitment cannot be open-ended. He pledged to begin withdrawing American forces in July 2011. The president said he wants to show the world that, quote, our cause is just, our resolve unwavering. In the studio with me is Charles Sennett. He's the editor of the online globalpost.com. And Charlie, what is your gut reaction to this speech? I mean, do you have a greater sense or clarity about how the United States is going to operate in Afghanistan now?
I don't think he succeeded in establishing the clarity he needed to establish to convince the American people and the world, particularly the coalition, that this idea is going to succeed. But I think this is a president who is a masterful orator. I thought it was a very powerful speech, particularly at the end, where he took on the notion of the incredibly difficult challenges we face in the post-9/11 world. And I thought he really hit his stride when he began to talk about a sort of a diffuse enemy, and that it will be a very shadowy world in which we must operate, and that this will take a long time. And then he built toward how we'll have to rely on our core values as a country. And he reaches this sort of emotional crescendo where you really feel this is a president who understands how to communicate with this country in a very personal way. Where I feel less confident is when you get down to the math of what this surge will mean. The battlefield geometry, I have to say, from following it for a very long time, it still doesn't make sense to me. How 30,000 more troops helps you penetrate a movement like the Taliban, which is as entrenched as it is still defies logic even within the Army's own field manual. You know, if you look at the counterinsurgency field manual, the force ratios required for classic counterinsurgency are much higher than what we will ever have there. He talks about we need to go after al-Qaeda. McChrystal's own analysis, General McChrystal's own analysis, says there are 100 members of al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. 30,000 troops to break the back of 100 ragtag fighters of al-Qaeda who no doubt pose a great threat, but it just seems so disproportionate that I can't put the pieces together relying on the sort of the experts I know in counterterrorism and the great things I've learned from them, including General Petraeus. When I try to put together the wisdom they have and the sense of history they have of counterinsurgency, I have to say I can't make sense of this equation.
Well, we'll put the math to a counterinsurgency expert in just a moment. But very quickly, Charlie, anything in the speech that really surprised you?
I thought it was a little bit surprising when he said we will support efforts to open the door to the Taliban elements that would be, as General Petraeus would put it, reconcilable. I think that's a real opening. It's one I'm extremely interested in seeing where that will develop. And I think that holds great promise. If they can actually pull the Taliban in through some negotiations with those who want to come in and be part of the future of Afghanistan, that's very interesting to me. The linkage to Pakistan was critical, that we will have to think of this on both sides of the border, and critical, important, and yet I would say not well spelled out.
Spoke number three in this big wheel of strategy for Afghanistan. Success in Afghanistan, said the president, has to be linked to partnership. Well, on the thought of pulling the Taliban in and making them a part of the mainstream, let's turn to Masoud Aziz. He's a former diplomat, foreign policy analyst, and the founder of the Afghanistan Policy Council, a think tank in Washington. He joins us from Washington. Mr. Aziz, first of all, what do you think about pulling the Taliban in and making them a part of the mainstream? Is that even possible? possible, do you think, at this point in time?
I think that's something that we have to do. I thought that overall this president has, I have been impressed by him in terms of his capability of explaining extremely complex notions, did a fairly good job, and he touched upon two important issues that are critically important at the center of this engagement. One is the issue of how we are going to bring troops back, the civilian surge that would follow that, and this link to Pakistan. But I thought that on both of those occasions and overall in the speech, the president was short in detail and actually came short of setting the new strategy that everybody has been waiting for a very
Masood Aziz there, a former diplomat and founder of the Afghanistan Policy Council. The line went dead. Charlie?
Can you hear me now?
There you are. Masood Aziz, you're back with us?
I think I'm back.
You were just talking about the link
to
Pakistan.
On those two issues, yeah. I thought the president came a bit short. Now, he is trying to address a dilemma. At the same time that he's trying to comfort his domestic audience that U.S. troops will eventually have to exit Afghanistan, he also has to assure those in the region of Afghanistan that the U.S. is committed to a long-term partnership for stability. And that seems a very contradictory thing to do. But he can do that, and he did touch upon this in his speech, but I thought that he did not explain that very well. He did not explain how is it that he is going to be able to exit Afghanistan, although he said he will. At the same time, he was not able to explain to the people in Afghanistan and in Pakistan that the U.S. is committed for a long haul. Now, there's a way of doing that, and I'm hoping that following his speech, and this is only a speech, this is an extremely complex strategy, probably the most complex engagement that the U.S. has since World War II, that this would be a series of follow-up that his staff, his cabinet, will be out there explaining and supporting a strategy. And in that respect, what I would expect from the president and his cabinet is the following, is that in order to withdraw, in order to exit troops back from Afghanistan, because soon enough this would be a political issue and he has to run for president, he has to immediately start along the line now a surge in civilian capability, in massive economic aid, in building governance, and something else that's extremely important, a much broader regional strategy with players such as China, Russia, the Gulf States, the Central Asian countries, and even countries like Iran. I did not hear those things. I did not hear him being detailed enough about that. So I was disappointed as a whole on the details.
And when you say he has to start immediately a kind of civilian surge, are you talking another number that's in addition to the 30,000 he talked about tonight?
No, what I'm talking about is a strategy. General McChrystal put on the table a military strategy that's couched under counterinsurgency around the troop levels that we've been discussing in the past few weeks. There is no such thing on the civilian side. The State Department, other agencies, the President, the White House need to have on the table now a civilian economic development governance strategy that's equivalent to what McChrystal has put on the table. And we know there's a consensus, both on the military side and the civilian side, that this cannot be won by a military approach. So where is the rest of the strategy? That is economic development and a political regional approach to this issue. We all know that even if we transform Afghanistan to a Switzerland, which is impossible, but even that would not be sufficient because Al-Qaeda and the Taliban are in Pakistan. In fact, the leadership of the Afghan Taliban, the leadership of the Pakistani Taliban, and Al-Qaeda are all in Pakistan. And they're there not because they like the landscape there. They're there because they're supported institutionally. So this is what we have. This is the core of the issue in fighting the Taliban and the insurgents.
I want to pass a mic to Charles Sennett for just a sec, but first, briefly, Masoud Aziz, I mean, you're a former Afghan diplomat. Tell us how you think a President Obama's speech would have been received in Kabul tonight.
Well, again, the aspect in regards to both convincing his domestic audience in the U.S. that he needs to begin drawing down the troops at some point in time is extremely important, and at the same time, convince the Afghans and those in the regions, broadly speaking, that the U.S. will be committed. I thought that he was short on that. That perception, if you can imagine, a shop owner, of villagers in Afghanistan hearing that in just a year or two, U.S. troops will be withdrawing, he has to make his decisions about preparing himself for an eventual future where the Taliban may be ruling in his district. And that's the shopkeeper in Afghanistan. But those that are more powerful, that are supporting the Taliban, that are probably across the border, will also have to make that kind of planning. So this is, the president needs to be much more clear about this, on how the U.S. is engaged in this region, where the Taliban are, where the insurgents are, where the real risks are, even if we are able to build Afghanistan as being a perfect state that we all hope that eventually it will be.
Masoud, if I could just jump in and ask you, you know, I think that you really put your finger on this, that it had to be both a very complex mix of resolve and exit strategy. And I would agree with you that that is a very complicated message to convey. I'm not sure it's going to resonate very clearly in America, and I think you've explained that it may not resonate very clearly in Afghanistan. I wanted to ask you, going even further, about that shopkeeper you described. If you think about that shopkeeper, and he has more U.S. troops coming into Afghanistan who don't understand the country, who don't understand the history, the religion, what the Taliban is to that village and to that shopkeeper, couldn't this surge of 30,000 troops not just not be successful, but perhaps even be a setback, backfire, if those troops are perceived as occupying troops? Could that in some way almost strengthen the Taliban in the long run?
Well, no, I don't think that there's a risk to that. There's no doubt about this, is that if this lasts for too long and we don't see progress, then the issue would be settled, said that where people won't see progress, it would see occupation rather than anything else. We'll see U.S. troops, NATO troops everywhere, but there's no progress. So the shopkeeper that is somewhere in Helmand or in Kandahar or Farah, somewhere that is sitting there, has a small shop, if you can imagine that. One day, you know, the police comes in there, there's a corrupt police, is ask him for a kickback. The next day, the Taliban comes in there and tells him that, listen, we saw you with the police, so we're going to kidnap your kid, make more demands on them. The next day, coalition troops show up and ask him to tell him where the Taliban are. This shopkeeper is now juggling on a daily basis the kind of decision that he's making and juggling these enormous powers that are coming at him. Eventually, he's going to break. This has been the situation for a very long time. So the key is not as much that, or these 30,000 troops are not going to make that much of a difference where the shopkeeper is going to sway one way or the other. This shopkeeper needs to see progress in terms of his livelihood. So perhaps the addition, because the light footprint strategy in Afghanistan has been a disaster, we have not had much going on in the south and the east in terms of presence of force. Now that additional number of troops is going to establish that, and the hope is that, and that's my suggestion, is that if President Obama is starting to talk about an exit strategy, he needs to couch it in the following terms, that the troops have to somehow exit, but the U.S. will still support Afghanistan and Pakistan with other means, with engaging the partners, the regional partners, and with economic aid. Remember what happened in 1989 when the Red Army withdrew out of Afghanistan after they were defeated? The U.S. stopped all aid in Afghanistan.
Masoud Aziz.
That condition led to the rise of the Taliban.
Masoud Aziz, we'll have to leave it there. Masoud Aziz, a former diplomat, foreign policy analyst, and the founder of the Afghanistan Policy Council, a think tank in Washington. Thank you so much for your time. Now, turning to Juan Cole, who is a professor of modern Middle East and South Asian history at the University of Michigan. Juan Cole, thanks for joining us. There was a fair amount of talk about Pakistan, considering this was a speech about Afghanistan. I'd like to get your reaction to that, how well President Obama kind of brought Pakistan into this AFPAC strategy, as it's been known.
Right. That was a key part of the speech. I lived in Pakistan for some time. I speak the language. I think the Pakistani public has become more amenable to a struggle against the Taliban. The Taliban, I think, were seen initially as a kind of anti-imperial force, as a force for local culture. But in the past year and even 2 years, their stock has fallen dramatically. So that helps Obama. And I think a lot of Pakistanis like the idea of U.S. Civilian aid, which he's offering $7.5 billion. But the Pakistani public really resents a big U.S. military footprint in their region. Pakistan was born in a struggle to get white Christian Britishers out of their country, and they don't want them back. So Obama is swimming uphill when he's asking the Pakistanis to go against their national interest, and he is, insofar as he's asking them to cease supporting Muslim activists among the Pashtuns who are pro-Pakistani, and to essentially let the government evolve in Kabul in a direction that Pakistanis see as pro-Indian.
Did you hear a solid plan, though, for how the president is going to link Pakistan and Afghanistan in this strategy?
Well, the plan is obvious, and he's been pursuing it already, which is to strong-arm the Pakistani government and military into actually taking on the Taliban in the northwest frontier province and in the federally administrated tribal areas, kind of almost like their Indian reservations, where the Taliban have had a safe haven. The Pakistani military has been pushed by the Obama administration into waging several major campaigns, one in the Swat Valley and now at the moment in South Waziristan, against Pakistani Taliban. And I think the hope is that eventually they can persuade the Pakistani government and military to take on the heavy-duty Taliban and al-Qaeda forces that are in North Waziristan and elsewhere in Pakistani territory.
Juan Cole, stick with us for just a moment, please. I want to get a military reality check from Steve Metz. He's an expert in counterinsurgency at the U.S. Army War College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. Steve Metz, thanks for joining us on the line. Tell us, can these 30,000 troops actually make a difference in the time that President Obama is giving them? I mean, they're supposed to start leaving in July 2011. That's 18 months out. And can they also train Afghan soldiers at the same time?
Well, I think it's certainly true that they will make an immediate difference. I mean, that number of high-quality troops certainly will change things. I think the big question, though, is whether by 2011 the Afghan security forces really will be able to control the area, to conduct operations on their own, because everything I've heard indicates that they really have a long way to go. And that's not a long time to really turn them into an effective force.
I mean, earlier in the show, Juan Cole, before the speech, we heard from a soldier in Kandahar today saying that the war in Afghanistan is a lost cause. Do you think that soldier would have been motivated by the speech tonight?
This was an American or soldier or a...
It was an American soldier, yeah.
I see. Well, I mean, you know, the military in Afghanistan has been a little bit demoralized by a lack of sense of mission, of light at the end of the tunnel, of exit strategy, and also of poor resourcing. So I think there will be U.S. military forces who will be happy about the commitment of greater resources, but... I think one problem that President Obama has not addressed is winning hearts and minds among the Pashtun people. He hasn't said how he will do that, and it's an uphill battle. There are virtually no troops in the Afghan army from Helmand and Kandahar provinces where the heaviest fighting is going on. Those are also the biggest sources of the opium production, an issue that Obama did not address. It's a
right.
Very thorny thing.
Back to Steve Metz. I mean, in the lead-up to this speech, some people have said that the low number of troops was about 20,000, the high about 40,000, this number of 30,000 right in the middle. Is the number the key element of the strategy? I mean, are there other considerations at play that you did not hear about tonight?
I would say the number is not the key consideration. It's a mistake that people often make, for example, when they look at what happened in Iraq in 2007, is they look at the number of troops to try to decide if that's enough or not. In Iraq, what made a difference was not just the number, but how they were used. And that's the key thing here is whether it's 20, 30, 40 really doesn't matter as much as how they're going to be used. And the president did specify that they'd really be used for two things. And one is to secure key sites, but the other is to reemphasize the training and advisory mission.
And I want to go back to Charlie Sennett's question earlier about just the math of this whole strategy. 30,000 troops to tackle 100 Qaeda fighters and Taliban, well, 100 Qaeda fighters in the mountains. Can you help us figure that one out, Steve Metz?
Well, if it were just force on force, if it were American troops against 100 al-Qaeda fighters, it would be one thing. But the whole key to counterinsurgency is that you have to provide around-the-clock, seven-day-a-week security in vastly dispersed places. So, I mean, that's the reason that counterinsurgency tends to have these sort of force ratios where it takes a lot more counterinsurgents than it does insurgents because of the nature of the task.
Are the force ratios sufficient, do you think, to be able to accomplish that goal?
The force ratios would certainly not be sufficient to have an overwhelming presence in every village in some places as large as Afghanistan. The key is whether the numbers will be sufficient to secure key installations and, more importantly, to upgrade the ability of the Afghan security force. I mean, ultimately, you have to look at not just the number of Americans, the number of NATO forces, but, I mean, the big key all along is the number of effective Afghan security forces.
Steve Metz, an expert in counterinsurgency at the U.S. Army War College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, and Juan Cole, professor of modern Middle East and South Asian history at the University of Michigan. Thank you both very much for joining us. Final question for you, Charlie Sennett, and we were talking about this a bit earlier. What do you think is the significance of where President Obama actually gave this speech tonight, the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, briefly?
I think it was very important, very symbolic. I think it was laden with emotion that he's recognizing this is a fateful and consequential decision for his presidency and for the country, and particularly for the sacrifices that the American military make for this country.
Charles Sennett, editor of the online journal GlobalPost.com, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Marco.
You've been listening to coverage of President Barack Obama's speech from the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, New York. The president warned that Afghanistan has moved backward and that huge challenges remain. He said the Taliban has gained momentum and al-Qaeda has safe havens along the border with Pakistan, but Mr. Obama said the war is not lost, and he announced he's ordered an additional 30,000 U.S. troops to fight it. The president balanced that announcement with a pledge to begin withdrawing troops in 18 months. He said, "We must deny al-Qaeda a safe haven. We must reverse the Taliban's momentum, and we must strengthen the capacity of Afghanistan's security forces and government." Mr. Obama said his new policy is designed to bring this war to a successful conclusion. Three main points in his strategy. One, the military strategy has to be the one that will break the Taliban. Two, we need to work with partners. The United States needs to work with partners, being the UN and Afghan government. And success in Afghanistan, number three, has to be linked to partnerships with Pakistan. You can find the rest of today's news at theworld.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We're back tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.